So moved. I don't think my microphone was on. But the minutes have been approved as mailed out and now filed. Now is the public comment period. Anyone who wishes to make a comment on an item of business that is not on our agenda is welcome to come forward at this time. You have 3 minutes to make your comment. When you come forward, please state your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Stephen Hansen. I'm a local physician. I read in your minutes of last month that a woman was here saying that 4 people have died of coccidioidomycosis in the North County. She was concerned that building a solar facility up there was going to disturb the soil and cause more trouble. On the county website, I found a nice report, an amalgamation of current recommendations about building in endemically infected soil for cocci. I don't know if that was available to you at the time, but that means wide dissemination. I never been able to figure out what the Health Commission really does, but I think you could have an educational focus. I think you could have an advocacy focus and make sure that anybody who's doing work up in the North County that involves a lot of disruption of the soil does it in a very sensitive manner, not doing it when the wind is high, and doing ways to mitigate the soil disruption. Believe me, they will lose every one of their workers' comp cases when those folks get cocci from working in that environment. So it's in their best interest as well. Finally, the local medical society, after the 1992 epidemic, which was caused by the big earthquakes that let a lot of spores into the air, went to the AMA and the CDC and the NIH and passed a resolution asking for the development of a coccidioidomycosis vaccine. Cocci is a complex mucopolysaccharide. It's not easy. It's very much in the status of an orphan drug, you know, because we just a few states are involved and only a few people get really sick with it, but a lot of non-immune compromised people get sick. I'm asking for a letter from you folks or from the county asking for reinstatement of that research program at CDC. It languished in the past 8 years or so. They certainly haven't given up on it. The scientists believe it's possible. It could save a lot of lives as more population encroaches on the areas in the Central California Valley and Arizona and other places. Finally, you probably have heard about the tobacco-free initiatives in the hospitals. French went tobacco-free. That means no tobacco at all on their campus. On December 1st, Sierra Vista and Twin Cities will do so January 1st. That leaves Arroyo Grande. They need a little stimulus. They've agreed to work on it, but it would be easier if all the campuses adopted this approach. It's much easier to explain it to people that way. And finally, the county health campus is thinking about being smoke-free. They've just got too much on their plate. They told me to do it right. They also need a little stimulus. And lastly, the sheriff's department. I know. The sheriff's department is one of the very few sheriff's facilities that still allows smoking in California. And that could be taken care of by the sheriff right now. I invite your help. It might be feel good to actually do something here, folks. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Dr. Hansen. Is there anyone else who would like to make a comment? Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner Hetherington would like to respond to some of Dr. Hansen's remarks.
Dr. Hansen, I just want you to realize that the reason that that cocci piece is on the web page is because of the Health Commission. We've been tracking it for a number of years. We've watched the spikes. We asked at the last outbreak that there be a dissemination to all the planning commissions, the city councils throughout the county, especially in North County, that they are aware that when soil is disturbed in some of these areas, there's a great potential for coccid.
Now you have to work with any private contractors.
I wish we had control over them.
Okay. I think there was someone else who wanted to make a comment. Please state your name.
My name is Michael Axelrod, and I'm executive director of Project Amend. And I'd like to think most of you are aware that Project Amend has been working for years to bring residential treatment and social model detox to San Luis Obispo. 2 weeks ago, a gentleman from the California Department of Alcohol and Drug Programs came, walked through our facility, looked at our program, found both to be exemplary. Today we received an invoice from the ADP that we gathered up the last monies we had, wrote a check, and sent it to Sacramento. So God willing, either by the end of this week or this time next Monday, San Luis Obispo will have medically assisted social model detox here in town and a 90-day drug and alcohol treatment program. Because of budget issues at the state level, we were told that our application, which was sent in August, wouldn't be reviewed until maybe 6 to 9 months, which we wouldn't have survived. And thanks to some of the gentlemen that sit up here, Lenthal and Gibson and Assemblyman Blakeslee and Senator Maldonado, they not only looked at our application, but they expedited the whole process, bumped it up to priority. And so, like I said, this is a real exciting time for drug addicts and alcoholic in this county. They don't know it yet, but for the first time in quite a while, they'll be able to have local services. I just wanted to come and avail myself of the opportunity to let you folks know. So thank you so very much.
Thank you very much for letting us know. That's good news.
It is. Thank you.
Commissioner Warren?
Mr. Axelrod, I have a question. Is this residential treatment and detox for just men or for men and women?
Now, Ms. Warren, it's for adult men 18 years and over.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I just want to thank you for your perseverance, you and your board. This has been a very long haul, and thank you. It's been a long time coming, and we really need it.
You know as well as I do, if not more than I do. And it just seemed like we were just busting through walls, and we busted through the last wall and looked around, and it's like, this is it. I think we've made it this time next Monday.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to make a comment? Very well. Then we'll move on to the next item on our agenda, which this December we have in the past had nonprofits come and talk to us about their individual programs. We've changed our format just a little bit. We're still focused on nonprofits, and Commissioner Warren will introduce our program for the evening.
Thank you. And I want to thank the commissioners for allowing us to make a little change from the previous years. I think there's a lot for the community to learn about how nonprofits work and what the nonprofits can do for the community and how they can help stabilize and sustain the nonprofits. I've had the opportunity this year to have a number of trainings that have begun being offered in our county, and was so impressed by the presenters that are here this evening that I really wanted to see the community have that opportunity to hear their wonderful presentations. So we have Greg Fitzgerald from VisionWorks Associates, Rick Cohen from Big Brothers Big Sisters, Barry Vanderkellen from the Slo County Community Foundation, Rick London from the United Way of Slo County, and Maria Fabula from the Nonprofit Support Centers. So take it away, Greg.
Well, Chair Evans and members of the Commission, we do appreciate the opportunity to, there it is, we made it, come tonight and just remind folks about the importance of the nonprofit sector. I'm going to lead off this segment and be followed by Rick Cohen from Big Brothers and Big Sisters, who will talk about, will follow up on some comments I make about boards of directors, and then Barry Vanderkellen, really helping us understand how nonprofits get funding. And then Rick London, who has this year brought about something called the Collaboration Forum, and we'll discuss something that's come up especially in tougher economic times, but recently in the past 4 or 5 years, collaboration among nonprofits to avoid duplication of services and to build some economies of scale. And then my dear friend Maria Fabula will give us some statistics about this county. So I'll begin by talking about the importance of the nonprofit sector. Any economy in the world now is considered to have three sectors, and we're very familiar with the private sector, which is privately owned and profit-motivated businesses. The public sector, you all should be very familiar with the public sector, I would think. We're in one of their buildings, right? And this is organizations that are owned by government. And then there is what we like to refer to as the social economy, or the third sector, it's called, or the nonprofit sector, that really deals with a variety of community and social issues, as well as it does take into its purview associations, and actually homeowners associations fit in this and so forth. So why would we have a social economy? Oh, I should also mention that we call it nonprofit, but that's only in this country a tax status, not a business plan. And my conference will talk about that a little more, too. A social economy develops in response to community issues and needs, usually social, economic, environmental, those kinds of things. Its purpose is to really deal with an issue and satisfy the needs of underserved parts of our population. And you'd be, what is the benefit? Sorry. So by using these kinds of solutions to reach those aims, we see that this social economy helps us to build a stronger, more sustainable, and more inclusive community. Now, this started right here where we live. This tradition of what's been called organized neighborliness, it's a good term. I found that on the internet the other day. I thought I'd use it. But it is distinctly American. Prior to this, in Europe, you'll remember that religious organizations and monarchies and the nobility, and of course extended family, really cared for folks. But when we got to the when the pilgrims got to the United States, they found a completely different reality. People were much more self-sufficient and needed to be more self-sufficient. And when the westward and southward movement came of the pioneering families, folks had to work together to build the infrastructure that was needed long before there was government. And so this is where this happened. So, and we use the example of if folks needed a school, most of the parents built the school and then pooled their money to hire a teacher to come out and educate their children. So this is a distinctly American phenomenon and tradition. And just as part of the proof, and Rick reminded me that there is a de Tocqueville society in the United Way, but Alexis de Tocqueville, in his work in 1831 called Democracy in America, was fascinated with what he said was the propensity of small groups of citizens to come together voluntarily to use their time and money to provide services for their fellow citizens. So it was being written about internationally in 1831. And you can see that it was particularly American because it was getting widespread publicity everywhere else. It just hadn't been done before. This is part of the American experience. In the beginning, some of our founding fathers believed that nonprofit organizations, or these voluntary associations of the social economy, should be regulated just like corporations. In fact, that's come back in recent years. Once the Sarbanes-Oxley bill was passed to control corporate spending and corporate behaviors, corporate ethical behaviors, we soon after that found some a nonprofit legislation that was very similar. For example, in California, if you are a nonprofit with an income of more than $2.5 million, you have to go by a completely different set of rules that are based on Sarbanes-Oxley. But others believed at the time that the right to create these associations and these organizations was very similar to the right of free assembly. And it actually took the Supreme Court in 1818 to decide on this issue, not once and for all, but for the first time. And since then, we've had tax laws that have been changed and so forth. Nonprofits are organized in a state. So any nonprofit operating in California that is based in California has to apply to the Secretary of State, like any other corporation, and abide by the regulations of the state of California. As far as their tax status, that is both regulated by the state in which the nonprofit has its principal office and by the federal government through the Internal Revenue Service. So what does this third sector do? Well, you're going to hear some of those things, but you're well aware of most of those things do. They play a critical role in things like the arts, school funding outside of what government does. You know, we have a lot of foundations for private schools now, for public schools that help to bring arts back into the schools, for example. Environmental causes and issues, human services, services for those who are more disadvantaged than we are, education, and now a big part of it is international humanitarian assistance. And you see that when there, well, the tsunami, for example, floods from the monsoons in India and so forth. We see a lot of that from here. So where has this grown? Well, this is very interesting, and I've verified all these things when I found them, but the third sector is growing faster than business or government internationally, which is very powerful. It had lagged behind until about the 80s, and then there was this tremendous upsurge of nonprofit, and they're called non-governmental organizations around the world. It's actually now 10% of our employment. We tend to think of the third sector as these little groups of do-gooders out there somewhere, but it's actually a very powerful force. It's projected to need, unbelievably, nearly 750,000 new senior managers by 2016. And by senior, I don't mean people our age. I mean, you know, like, we're not going to be doing that in 2016. I hope. Worldwide, it's a $1 trillion-a-year industry. I love that. If you look at the last thing, if the nonprofit sector were a separate national economy, it would be the eighth largest economy in the world, ahead of those countries, Brazil, Russia, Canada, Spain, and Mexico. Fascinating. So this is a powerful force in our society and around the world. It is 4.7% of the world's gross domestic product. It's higher than that in the United States, by the way. It's 5% of all non-agricultural employment in the world. It's over 9% of service employment and 30% of all public sector employment. It's pretty big. Now, what fuels this? And I will ask if anybody has an idea of how much money was contributed just in the United States to charitable causes last year. Come on, Pam, take a guess. Okay, anybody else? And I would say go higher. All right, Jesse.
I'll say 50 billion.
Okay, keep going. Up. Hmm?
150.
Okay, you're about a third of the way. Actually, next slide. It was $306.39 billion in charitable giving in the United States last year. And it's been on a steady increase for the past 35 years that it's been tracked, even in bad years. In 2002, it was modest, it was only about 3.4%. Get that slide? There we go, my assistant. And most people think corporations give, but if you look at this chart, it's interesting. Corporations do give pretty well, $15 billion. Now, as we would say, that ain't hay. However, if you look through this, the combined bequest, family foundation, and individual giving was over $250 billion. That was last year alone, and it's 88% of all giving. That means that just ordinary folks are the ones that keep this economy going. It's surprising to me. Let's look at California. Other way. It's okay. One more. There we go. Across the United States, there are about 1.5 million nonprofit organizations. And this is an astounding number, isn't it? In California alone, there are over 100,000 public charities, 13,000 foundations, over 36,000 membership organizations. We are home to over 10% of all nonprofits in the United States, right here in California. Of course, we're home to more than 10% of the population, so it makes some sense, doesn't it? But we have more nonprofits than New Jersey, North Carolina, Massachusetts, and Virginia combined. Oh, and Hawaii, combined. The revenue is $118 billion with $195 billion in assets, or about 3 charities for every 1,000 people. It's a very powerful part of our economy that we can no longer take for granted at all. In California, employment, nearly 1 million employees in the nonprofit sector. It's very powerful. It's 1 out of every 17 workers. I had to look at this, too. It came from California EDD that nonprofits employ more people than the government of the state of California and the construction industry in California last year. It's powerful. It's a powerful, powerful. And one last thing we need to look at is volunteers. So in the 2 years between 2005 and 2007, there were nearly 7 million volunteers in California. So this third sector is fueled by people's money and people's time. These people dedicated almost 1 billion hours of service. And they're just the volunteers' effect, the economic contribution of those hours, was over $17 billion. So this is really about how people care for each other in a very much an American invention. So it's very powerful, and we wanted to start off tonight by just letting you know how big we are, how much impact this has. Maria will close up by talking about specifically San Luis Obispo County, but I'd like to show you one last thing, and this is a new trend. Between 5.5 and 8.5 million Americans have launched their second career in nonprofits. And when asked, they said that it was because they wanted to combine to get more meaning out of their work along with continued income. Now, we know that in general the nonprofit sector lags behind the private sector in pay scales for some. But as we live longer, we don't retire and die like it used to be at the turn of this last century. We're actually living to be, my 80-year-old mother, for example, just bought a new Mustang. So, and she just retired from her second career, which was in the nonprofit sector. But we see that that's really the common trend. And when we see this need for 600,000-plus senior managers coming up, we are going to have to rely for a while on us, all of us. When I was 50, which was a little while ago, we decided to change our company. We work only with nonprofits and local government entities now. We used to work with for-profit clients and banks and credit unions. And when I was 50, we just decided we're going to change and we're going to bring business practices to nonprofits. And we're not alone. All the people you see here have done the same thing. So thanks for helping me. Set this off. Do you have any questions about this? Jesse?
Oh, you mentioned that 1818 Supreme Court decision affecting the nonprofits. Can you tell us what was decided there?
You know, it wasn't a final decision,
but
court sided with those who believed that this was a fundamental right included in the Constitution, basically under the First Amendment. But they said that it was the beginning of the nonprofit board system that we have now. You know, all nonprofits have to have an unpaid community board of directors whose job it is to represent all of the donors and public entities that, provide funds for this to make sure that in exchange nowadays for a tax benefit, remember in 1818 there wasn't that, that there is someone safeguarding the public interest. And that was what that court decision talked about, that if these if there was going to be less regulation of these people, what they wanted to see was that a group of neighbors oversaw the operations of the nonprofits, and that that would be good enough. Okay? Sure. Anyone else? All right. So I'm turning it over to Rick Cohen, who's going to talk a bit about the next phase of nonprofits, the board.
Thanks, Greg. I'm Rick Cohen with Big Brothers Big Sisters of San Luis Obispo County. And you'll notice I think I'm going to be uniquely positioned two ways tonight. One is I believe at this esteemed panel, I'm the only one that heads a direct service nonprofit organization in the county. And two, I'm the low-tech member. I came into this county low-tech, and I'm going to be leaving low-tech, so there's no PowerPoint, there's no overheads. I'm going to exercise my power to get right to the point. And then my point tonight is, kind of bringing it home. I think Greg did a wonderful job explaining the role of nonprofits, or as he calls it, social economy. And what does that mean for us locally? I firmly believe that 2009 is going to face some challenges we haven't seen here before. We're going to see nonprofits going away, hopefully not as many, because both Rick and Barry are working really hard to ensure nonprofits do some collaboration. But I'm here to talk about board members and the role of board members in this community. The nonprofit reach is arguably greater than any other sector when one factors in the number of people employed, those who volunteer, those who sit on boards, those who donate, and those who are recipients of myriad services. You'll hear from others on this panel how nonprofits locally, how they're funded, managed, and staffed, and how they can and do work together to serve the community. I'm here to talk about the nonprofit boards. Directors, specifically what I view to be their most important functions. And that's something that's evolved over the years. And I'm not saying that I'm the final authority on that, but through my experiences, I think I've come up with what I think is the most essential functions for nonprofit boards today. San Luis Obispo County is home to nearly 1,000 or maybe just over 1,000 nonprofits, a majority of which are small and the result of grassroots movements. Somebody had a vision of a need that wasn't met, and these nonprofits were formed. Not long ago, nonprofit agency boards of directors were largely comprised of people with good intentions, commonly those who were part of the grassroots movement, volunteers for the organization, in some cases recipients of those services. There are still a significant number of local agencies that continue this practice. While nonprofits have been around for many decades, only in somewhat recent times have they realized that in order to compete and survive, they must adopt sound business practices. Kind of new, relatively new in the overall scheme of nonprofits. You got to be a business. It's more than just doing good and thinking good things. They must have the skills necessary to manage finances, supervise personnel, effectively market their services, and become trusted stewards of public support. That's the basics. The sophisticated nonprofit agency today supports a board of directors that can govern to ensure compliance with all governmental regulations, agency policies, and maintain fiduciary responsibilities. The more effective nonprofit board agencies build boards of directors that also willingly exercise a range of influence and or affluence to bring more resources to the table. While it may sound a bit mercenary, and I've been accused of that, I've learned over my many years as a nonprofit executive the importance of inviting to my boards primarily individuals who will gladly talk about the organization with an express purpose to build resources. In other words, if you want to sit on my board of directors, you better be ready to bring money to the table. Again, mercenary. Or, of course, in-kind services that have a dollar value or volunteer services. Such practices, assumes and requires that the nonprofit board or the agency itself has a competent staff in place to manage the day-to-day operations and overall business model that I mentioned earlier. Many local grassroots organizations don't have enough money to employ a complete staff. Thus, there becomes more reliance on board members to fill some of those day-to-day operations. And I submit that volunteers should be recruited for those things and for the non-paid staff roles, and the board members should focus on resource development. not day-to-day operations. Again, not to sound mercenary, though I do, but without money, most nonprofit services cannot be provided. Think of those services. The services we all provide is the heart of the organization. That's why we beat. And think of the money as the bloodstream that feeds the heart and keeps the heart beating. One can't function without the other. So I can feel good about being a mercenary when I say the money is the blood that pumps the heart. You may recall Greg sharing earlier the fact that nearly 75% of funding of nonprofits comes from individuals. I don't know that there's many people that believe and understand that. I hear a lot of folks that think corporations and foundations like Barry's fit the bill, and they certainly fit a huge bill, but not the total bill. The best way to tap into the generosity of those 75% of individuals is through the collective network of an involved and financially committed board of directors. Now, how does the nonprofit organization go about finding these very special board members like Dr. Marty Craven? Right, Marty? You're a rainmaker. He's a rainmaker on the board in which he sits. I knew I'd wake you up. You said you didn't want said you have to listen to me again tonight. Yes, you did. I like to start by having a frank conversation with my existing board members to assess our current board structure. It's essential to have the backing of a board president like Marty Craven, who will lead by example when it comes to community outreach efforts and be willing to encourage that all board members have that same type of devotion. A healthy board will be diverse in its ability to attract support. We're talking about geographically and industry-wide comprised. The more geographically comprised and industry comprised, the greater the sphere of influence. Common to most boards are members that will be in law or in finance. We've all found that's a real prudent way to get some free advice and some free work that's done. Beyond that, the door is wide open. As you know, San Luis Obispo County is replete with high-profile industries, be it banking, retail, technology, real estate, hospitality, construction, education, government, etc. To build greater agency capacity, existing board members should be asked to identify people they personally know who might be good candidates to further the cause. New board member prospects must be told in advance that they're being courted because of the assumption that they will reach out to others and they have a network that they can bring to help broaden the agency's support base. It's okay to ask prospects if they're actually able to be, if they're in a position of influence or affluence. You don't have to be bashful. The worst thing to do is bring a board person on and have him or her find out quite accidentally that there is an expectation that they bring resources to the organization. Another way to build a board is by looking at agency's donor base. Does this agency have an unusually large donor or more that's at arm's length from the organization that might be tapped to be a board member, someone who will reach out on their behalf, because chances are that generous donor hangs around with some other generous people in the community. Likewise, an agency may review its volunteer base for board prospects. Yes, volunteers can have the financial resources and influence to bring greater agency support. Yet another way to recruit board members is by paying attention to the local newspapers and chambers of commerce publication. I can't tell you over the years how many times my agencies have discovered a need for board members, and perhaps we've exhausted who we know collectively. When a new business comes to town, sometimes I try and be the first person to approach that new business leader and talk about organization and see if I can perhaps engage that person in that business in our organization. Likewise, we read about in the paper some emerging business leaders, management folks that have been around for a long time and well-known businesses. Now suddenly they're in a position of greater power and greater influence. Again, I try and be among the first agencies to go out there and welcome that person to that position and see if perhaps we can engage them in our organization. One thing that makes a big difference, you know, it's easy for me to stand here as the director of Big Brothers Big Sisters because we have a pretty well-known cause. So that opens a lot of doors. But there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of great causes here. As long as the agency is positioned to articulate that cause, they can open some doors and walk in and find some folks who will enlist the support of others. Building an effective board is more than just bringing bodies into the fold. I always try and pay attention to how the board of directors interacts and conducts business. Is everyone on the same page? Are self-serving interests getting in the way of progress? Is everybody pulling his or her own weight on the board? is staff effectively doing its job of keeping board members aware and motivated by reporting on agency services and those who benefit by the agency mission. Board members should also be an integral component of strategic planning. Looking beyond the horizon and adjusting the circumstances is not something new to successful business leaders. They can bring that practice to the nonprofit table. That same sense, I just said that. Knowledge is useful in the nonprofit world, so a visionary and business-savvy board can bring a lot more to the table than money and other essential resources. While there's a whole lot more I can say about the development and role of nonprofits, I'll stop right now because this is just the basics. I could probably go on for hours speaking directly to a nonprofit organization about the things they can do to ensure a very effective board, but we don't have time for that tonight. And I'm going to pass the baton to, I believe, next up to bat is Barry Vanderkillen with the San Luis County Community Foundation. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Barry Vanderkillen. I'm the Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation. And I want to begin by thanking you for your service to the people of the county on this, in your important work. I admire people like you who step forward and take on these positions of responsibility for the because you're doing it more than just for pay. But that's beside the point. I'm honored to be on this panel tonight with my colleagues. They all are extraordinary in their ability to provide leadership to the nonprofit community. And so I'm going to try to give a few more comments in context and hopefully not steal the thunder of the people who are following me. And I've prepared just a few comments, and I'll try to keep my my remarks to less than 2 hours. In San Luis Obispo County, there are about 1,100 501c3 organizations. In the nonprofit section of the tax code, there are 28 or 29 different types of nonprofit organizations. It's the C3 organizations, the magical three at the end, that allows donors to receive a tax benefit for giving money. And so in San Luis Obispo County, there are, as of October, there are 1,159 such organizations. 47% of these organizations have revenue less than $25,000. That's a lot of small groups of very passionate people that are engaged in some issue affecting the quality of life in this county. I'm not so sure that we have too many or we don't have enough, or we have too many or we don't have enough. When I think about how the nonprofit community is organized in this county, I keep coming back to the point it reflects the overall business community of this county. This county is based on small businesses, and the nonprofit community is a collection of small businesses. So when we look at the profile of the nonprofit community, we have to look at that and see that it is parallel to the overall business community. And if we keep that in proper perspective, then we look at the issues facing the nonprofit community in a different light. Total revenue for the nonprofits, these 501c3 organizations, is estimated to be $402 million. And that's off of the annual tax filing, the Form 990. Any nonprofit organization that has annual revenue of $25,000 or more must file this Form 990. It's an information return to the IRS. It's the long form. Now the IRS is requiring a short form for the smaller organizations, so every nonprofit now has to file an annual report with the IRS. And after 3 years of noncompliance, they can get kicked out of the mother Bible of the publication 78 with the IRS. And if you get kicked out of Pub 78, you're not in compliance with the IRS, and there's a whole bunch of things that happen, including foundations and corporations will no longer send you money. So it's in your it's in the nonprofit's interest to stay in compliance with IRS rules and regulations. You can see now how the revenue is, where the money comes from. We heard a little bit about the overall statistics, the $300+ billion of charitable giving nationwide. And in, this is San Luis Obispo County data from the National Center for Charitable Statistics. And I apologize, I'm pulling my numbers together here. Gifts and grants comprise about $13 million. And so you can see of the $400 million in annual revenues, about $13 million from private gifts and grants. I want to pull particular attention to that small slice of the pie called net special events. That's the net revenue from all the special events that are held in the county. It's a little bit over $4 million. As we heard earlier, corporations aren't the place to turn for nonprofits to get money. Foundations, a little bit more. Corporations give about 5% of all the money that's donated nationwide. Foundations give about 12%. Individuals give 88%. And so when we look at the special events, those are very popular things to do, but they really don't produce that much money. So we have to look at our special events different than simply raising money. They have to be to raise our profile, to communicate our message, to get people engaged in our organization. But if we go into our special events simply to raise money, there are more effective and efficient ways to do that, and that is by working with individuals. The flip side to that is that working with individuals takes time and takes consistency, and a lot of nonprofits that are woefully understaffed don't have the ability to maintain that consistency. So the default is to, let's go to the local corporation, let's have a special event. And that's something that we need to keep in mind as we all rise up to the level of being on the board of a nonprofit, or I hope that you all will one day if you're not already, and not just say, a special event will save us. To really focus on engaging individuals in the life of the enterprise is where the real action is. In 2006, the United Way, in partnership with Pacific Gas and Electric, conducted an economic impact study of nonprofits in San Luis Obispo County. And some of the findings include that, on average, every resident of the county takes advantage of nonprofit services at least six times. Now, if we put in religious organizations, weekly attendance at services, that number goes way up, as you might imagine. But taking religious places of worship out of the mix, every resident has been touched in some meaningful way at least six times in the last year by nonprofits. That's vital services that aren't being provided elsewhere. And also what's interesting is, though, even though these are nonprofit organizations, they generate about $12 million in tax revenue for state and local coffers. And that's something that's not inconsequential. The health of the nonprofit community bolsters the health of the entire community. Slide. So I also have on my agenda that I'm going to be just introduce what our foundation. So I'll take advantage of this moment to tell you a little bit about the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation. And we were formed in May of 1998 to provide a public trust to enhance the quality of life for all the residents of the county. We go about our work in three ways. We grant, we gather, and we grow. We make grants to local nonprofits to make their programs and services more effective and efficient. We gather, we work with individuals and families to donate money strategically, and we grow endowments to provide for the ever-evolving needs of the people of the county. We like to think of our work as being for good and forever, and we manage the operations of the Community Foundation that we will be around forever. It is not without precedent for us to talk with somebody and say, what do you want your money to be doing 200 years from now? If we think about Benjamin Franklin and when he died and established charitable trusts in 1791, those trusts were active until 1991, providing scholarships to people to learn a trade, scholarships to people in Boston and Philadelphia. And those trusts were broken in 1991 because the way people learned trades changed. So those trusts are now endowments at the Franklin Institute in Boston and the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. Benjamin Franklin's vision that he established in 1791 continues. Lady Ann Molson created a scholarship fund at Harvard College in 1636. And in 2008, there are students at Harvard College being able to afford Harvard College because of her generosity 400 years ago. So that's the vision that we're trying to implant in people's minds of how they want to improve the quality of life today and 200 years from now in San Luis Obispo County. And we're very grateful for those people who have partnered with us and see us as a valuable partner. And that has led to us growing from our first gift in 1998 of $800 when a donor paid the filing fee with the state of California for us to incorporate. $800, we were worth $800 in 1998, and at the end of 2007, we were worth over $28 million. And that's real testimony to the people of San Luis Obispo County who are trying to help their neighbors. Sad to say that today we're worth a little bit less than $28 million, but aren't we all? And in the time that we've been in existence, we've made grants of over $12 million, a majority of which has stayed in San Luis Obispo County. We have a 15-member board of directors, currently chaired by John Dunn, the retired city manager for the city of San Luis Obispo. Our vice president, and will take over the board as president in January, is Wendy Brown, a local CPA. Our treasurer is Barbara Bell, a local civic leader. And our secretary and our treasurer is Bill Raver, the executive vice president of Heritage Oaks Bank. We recruit our board members throughout the county. We try to get not only geographic representation, but expertise to bring. We're a very complicated organization, and so we try to bring as many different perspectives as we can. And we rely on people and their local knowledge for us to make the best grants that we can out to the community. Last year in 2007, we made 367 grants. That's more than one a day, totaling $2.6 million. And we support organizations like we like to say, from the arts to the zoo. Any organization, a 501c3 organization, is eligible. And our discretionary grants is really focusing on strengthening our local nonprofit organizations so that they can be more effective and efficient in doing the good work that they do in the county. Foundations are money that are set aside that have a longer vision than being immediately spent. We like to think of the needs of the county representing your community, and we like to think of this organization as being your foundation. We are the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. I'd be happy to take any questions if you have them.
Yes, Barry, when you talked about the 990s, if someone was wanting to know more about a nonprofit and a little bit about how they operate, is that a tool that could be used?
Yes. In fact, nonprofit organizations in exchange for receiving tax-exempt status have to continually verify that they are providing public good. The trade-off for generating tax revenue is the generation of public good. And part of that verification, that accountability, is that anybody can ask at any time for a copy of the filings, the 990 or the short form, or the audited financial statements. Those are public records. Nonprofits can charge a fee for photocopying and mailing, but they have to provide those. So just know that you can knock on somebody's door and say, show me your 990, show me your audited financial statements. They have to show you them. You can sit there and read them for free. If you want to take a copy, they can charge you a small fee. Even better than that is that on the web at GuideStar.org, all of this is available to the public. Now, there are levels of access, and GuideStar charges a fee for various levels of access, but that's available. And the State Attorney General's Office has outsourced the posting of these public documents to GuideStar.org. And so go to the web, GuideStar.org, and look up your nonprofit and just see what's there. Thank you all very much. And I'm going to turn this over to Rick London from the United Way.
Good evening. Pleasure to be here and in such good company. I thank you very much. I was asked to talk about the collaboration forum, and on the agenda it actually says emerging strategies for nonprofits. And I wanted to emphasize the word shift. In September, United Way and the Community Foundation got together and hosted what we called a collaboration summit. It was, it actually morphed out of the collaboration forum, the San Luis Obispo Nonprofit Collaboration Forum, which has been providing forums, annual forums, for about 17 years. We've a variety of nonprofits, executive board members have participated, helping us put on these forums. And it's been about helping nonprofits understand best practices, a lot of trainings, and the collaboration summit, we were trying to facilitate thinking about having to deal with a new reality, the state budget, the California state budget, and the county state budget. I just have a slide up here, just kind of giving you a little bit of the parameters of what we're up against. Through June 2010, our legislature is looking at about a $28 billion gap, shortfall, about $11 billion through the end of this fiscal year. And that's after delaying the budget passage until after our summit that we had on September 19th, which was actually the anniversary of the first federal budget passed by the Continental Congress. Didn't seem to resonate with California, though. So we're facing significant challenges here in dealing with priorities. The Health and Human Service budget for the year ending June 30, 2009, is about $39 billion. So this article in the Sacramento Bee, if we could cut the state budget for health and human service by two-thirds and not raise taxes and balance the budget. I mean, this is just an example of really what we're up against as far as not funding University of California, California State University systems, close all the prisons, shut down public schools. The budget deficit is very substantial. And our nonprofit sector is very concerned. I use the term NGO, non-governmental organizations, because I like including the faith-based organizations as well. They do a tremendous amount of work in our county. Next slide, please. So how do we deal with this new reality? Some of the things that came out of the summit in September, it was clear that important strategy for survival is to develop priorities. We had Gene DaCosta, Cal Poly professor, PhD in organizational development. She gave a wonderful talk on climbing above the fear. There is a tremendous amount of concern in the nonprofit sector. Adapting to shift in resources will foster transformative collaborations. We were talking about the nonprofit sector looking at itself as a system, some hosted self-governing meetings came out of the summit through a open space technology where attendees got involved with suggesting an idea, and then they had to agree to host at least one meeting. So we have about six of those on volunteerism, employment, mentoring. So a couple of these groups are continuing, continuing the mindful dialogue. And necessity is the inspiration of innovation. So we're encouraged that these challenges will inspire us to meet the oncoming needs. I threw this slide up here. Coming up with priorities is not an easy task. I don't know how many of you have heard of the rule of three. People who are out in the wilderness are familiar with it. And it's pretty easy to know, you know, when you need air, exposed to extreme low temperatures, you don't have water. It's very easy to get a handle on our priorities. My son puts video games pretty close to air. I'm starting to see him starting to see it more in the food category, but I think he can go a day without playing now. this is really probably one of the greatest shifts happening right now. We're all facing it, a lot of us are facing it individually with our family budgets. Businesses are grappling with it, and our nonprofits are grappling with prioritizing revenue sources as well as what we can spend our funds on. The ogre story is something comparable to give a man a fish and he will eat for a day, teach him how to fish and he will eat for a lifetime. That's an old Chinese proverb. The ogre story is something United Way has been using to talk about community impact. And basically, a villager sees a baby floating down the river and rescues it. Next day sees two babies and grabs them both. The next day there's three babies. He's got to go get a friend. So this is capacity building and remediating the problem. And eventually what we need to do is we need somebody to go upstream. And we have an ogre up there throwing babies into the river. That ogre, we need to change the behavior. Next slide, please. We need to change the behavior, redirect the ogre, and put his energies to a better use. We have ogres throughout the world and our country, our state, and our county. We have them in our families, too. Drug addiction. I was very encouraged to hear the announcement today about the rehab alcohol rehab by Project Amends. There's an ogre there. And how we deal with the ogre is very important because it's more cost-effective. We're finding out we just can't afford to continue to treat symptoms. We really got to, we need to drill down to the causes of our problems and try to come up with sustainable, preventable change. This is truly a big challenge right now because we would like to do more prevention, and with the economy going the way it is, we're starting to see more people falling into harder times and requiring remediation, and it's become more challenging to put people back to work. Transformative collaborations increase awareness and individual priorities too. That was something I thought was we thought was pretty good that came out of the collaboration summit. That when we try to work together, we come up with ideas, new ideas to help ourselves individually and our own agencies. Next slide, please. In May of this year, United Way issued a challenge to America, a 10-year challenge, prioritizing education, income, and health, the building blocks to a good life. The goals were that by 2018, we'd like to cut by half the number of young people who drop out of high school. About 75% of our youth throughout the country graduate from high school on time. In San Luis Obispo County, it's closer to 90%. We'd like to cut by half the number of low-income families that lack financial stability. And we'd like to increase by a third the number of youth and adults that are healthy and avoiding risky behaviors. Education, income, and health, something Benjamin Franklin is known for, early to bed, early to rise. I like to say now makes a person healthy, wealthy, and wise. Next slide, please. What gets measured gets done. For example, taking our blood pressure. At my last physical, I found out my bad cholesterol dropped 20 points, which was like a, you know, woohoo. But I only knew that because my cholesterol has been monitored for some years now, as well as my blood pressure and sugar. And this gives me an opportunity to be aware of perhaps imbalances in my body. It gives me an opportunity to change my behavior, to increase my health. Personal decision. But we have this opportunity as far as the health of our communities. And as part of the 10-year challenge to America, we have come up with indicators under education, income, and health. And to be more specific, education helping children and youth achieve their potential, income promoting financial stability and independence through retirement, and health improving people's health. So in the same way I knew that my cholesterol was in check, we know, for example, under education that when children enter kindergarten, knowing their ABCs, can read or pretend to read, count to 20, and write their name, they're more likely to graduate from high school on time. We know that when children can read at third and fourth grade equivalent in third and fourth grade, they're more likely to graduate from high school on time. A percentage of 18 to 24-year-olds who are not working or in school. Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Community Foundation have a great program, Pathways to Adulthood, that is trying to keep that indicator in a healthy range. Under income, we know people are spending more than 40% of their income on housing, are less likely to have enough money to retire. We've benchmarked the percentage of folks with less than $300 in savings. There's too many of us that don't have enough money to handle car repairs. And health, United Way of San Luis Obispo County just awarded a $75,000 grant to Beginnings, the Beginnings Collaborative, where the issue of low birth weight is a factor as far as women who are unaware of their pregnancy and are using drugs and alcohol and affecting the birth weight of their children. Our community is seen as a system, just trying to show the interconnectedness and interdependence of healthy communities, how healthy people and businesses, healthy nonprofits, faith-based organizations, and our local state and federal governments are all interdependent. In 1887, in Denver, Colorado, a rabbi, two ministers, and a priest got together, and they realized they could mobilize the caring power of their community to improve lives by living united. And in 1887, that was the beginning of the United Way movement. And we are now, you may have seen some of our billboards, the Live United messages. We're trying to get it out everywhere. And this is my, I think this is my last slide. How wonderful it is that nobody needs to wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. That was said by Anne Frank. And I'd encourage you to check out liveunited.org. Thank you very much for your time. Any questions? Yes.
Yes, I was wondering on when the Community Foundation was established, I believe in 1998, did that have any effect, positive or negative, on your organization as far as fundraising?
I would say both. We don't have to do all the work. So we have a partner in the community, but the Community Foundation has is receiving funds that United Way may have received. On the other hand, the foundation is putting money away for the future, and most of our current donations are spent as we get them. We have different models for what we're doing. We're focused on education and health. We're primarily in health and human service, where the foundation is Arts to Zoo. So there are some differences, and we're very pleased to be collaborating with the foundation.
Has your revenue gone up in the past 10 years? Or
it has gone down.
It has gone down?
Yes. And we're looking to increase it. Yes.
What is United Way's administrative overhead?
20%.
Is that of major nonprofits? Is that average, below, above?
It would depend on your revenue. There's United Ways across the country with overhead rates under 10%, who have $5-10 million revenue streams. We're looking to, the more revenue we can bring in, the lower our overhead percentage will be. As I say, it's like flying a 747. You can't walk, there's only, you can only fly it so lean. You need to, fill it with passengers. Thank you.
I just wanted to say I saw that article in the Tribune yesterday and read that on both the Community Foundation and United Way, and I thought I find it really enlightening when you referred to your organization as kind of the checkbook and the Community Foundation as the savings for the nonprofits. It kind of gave a little more clear picture, or if you'd like to elaborate on that.
Well, again, I believe, our grant-making process is volunteer-based. We bring in the community to read grants. They're trained and understand our guidelines and our focus. We're nurturing our agencies from remediation into structural change. We're looking to increase impact. Tomorrow night we have our youth board meeting. We set up a youth board. We have 12 high school students from Atascadero, Mission, Prep, and San Luis Obispo High that will be allocating funds. They're going to be noticing the community of the youth board grant process. We've gotten involved with Born Learning. I don't know if you've heard of bornlearning.org. It's a program that's United Ways are advocating across the country that our children are born learning. And when we realize this, we can save them from certain problems as they grow up. So we're getting more into programming in the sense of focusing on education, income, and health, and that we have established these three priorities as something very valuable for our communities to focus on. Yes, Pamela.
What sort of programs do you have now in regards to the senior community?
We funded EOC to a large extent, the senior peer screening program. Most of our senior programs have been through funding on a grant basis. We look to, there is a component under income, promoting financial stability and independence. We're starting to see more seniors living in their cars. This seems to be a trend that retirement hasn't gone the way they thought, and their retirement funds have dwindled. So that's something we have our eye on, and that we're looking to help inspire strategies for dealing with that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Maria Fabula.
Good evening. My name is Maria Fabula, and I'm very pleased to be here representing the Nonprofit Support Center this evening. I'd like to thank Commissioner Warren for your dedication not only to the nonprofit sector, but also to convening this panel. I have looked at the numbers and sliced them and diced them a little bit different than my colleague Barry, but I want to go ahead and go over them. I also am excited to say that these were December 2008 numbers off of GuideStar, which we talked about. There are 1,925 nonprofit organizations in San Luis Obispo County. That's a big number. And this includes all nonprofit organizations. So nonprofits, not only C3s, but all of the 27 or 28 sections of the tax code. And if we look down the list here, the 1,367 are representing the 501c3s, so public charities and private non-operating foundations, like EOC, the Family Care Network, the Food Bank, the Land Conservancy, the Community Foundation. We look down the list, and at 501c4s, which represent civic leagues and social welfare organizations, consist of groups like the Lions, the Kiwanis, Rotary. We look down to 501c7. We have 107 nonprofits represented in our county, and these are mainly sports clubs, yacht clubs, little league clubs, and then down lastly, the largest next group is the 501c6s, which are your business leagues, your chambers, your Wine Country Alliance, the Visitors and Conference Bureau. So as you can see, nonprofits really are representing a huge number of organizations that do great benefit in our community. If we look at these numbers and break them down a little bit differently, of the 1,900, we're looking at about 1,587 that aren't that are generating less than $100,000 a year. So a lot of very small grassroots organizations doing good work in our community, providing a service. If we look at this chart, this also shows you that a majority of the nonprofit organizations in our community are small and generating under $100,000 a year. And in total, if you look at all nonprofits, again, C3s and all the way through down the tax code, we're generating $441 million in annual revenue into our community. And this is off of the Form 990. This is also a testament to the powerful collective nonprofit force that my colleagues referred to earlier. In San Luis Obispo County, we see that both the city of San Luis Obispo and Paso Robles have the largest number of nonprofits in their cities, respectively. And that if we go down the coast into Santa Barbara County, we see a very obnoxious number of 1,624 nonprofits in the city of Santa Barbara. In Santa Maria, we have about 475 nonprofits, and that really encompasses the whole Santa Maria Valley. If we look to our surrounding counties, we can see that, again, the first number is all nonprofit organizations. Both Santa Barbara County and Monterey County have very large nonprofit sectors that both bring in over $1 billion a year annually in their revenue. My colleagues referred to the new reality and economic challenges that we are, our nonprofit community faces. And we do feel that these economic challenges will bring need for more efficient nonprofits, but also nonprofit board members, staff, and volunteers all will need to access resources so that they can continue to do their good work in our community. Ooh, it's hard to read. So that's where the Nonprofit Support Center comes in. And the Nonprofit Support Center provides leadership, consulting, training, and advocacy to help nonprofits do their good work better. We started as a nonprofit in Santa Barbara, actually as a, we started as a program of the Santa Barbara Foundation, specifically providing capacity building support to their grantees. So providing such trainings as how to write a grant, how to build your board. And we quickly found out that it wasn't only the Santa Barbara Foundation grantees that needed our services, but it was actually the whole community. And we formed a separate individual 501c3 in 1995, and we have expanded into Santa Maria and here into San Luis Obispo this year, actually April 1st of this year. We opened a resource center in San Luis Obispo. We offer training programs for nonprofits. We offer peer-to-peer networking roundtables where nonprofit staff and volunteers can get together collectively and talk about their issues and challenges and hopefully come to resolve around some of these issues. I think the most exciting information on this screen is that in 2007, we trained over 3,300 nonprofit staff, board members, and or volunteers that year. And I anticipate that in 2008, that number will be closer to 4,000. So we believe at the Nonprofit Support Center all about agency success, and that in order for agencies to be successful in their mission, they really need to have business sense. So they need to be financially stable, they need to be have a stable organization and operation, and they need to have program success. So our programs that we offer to the community focus around several different, actually four core areas. Board effectiveness, which is around building your board. Rick talked a little bit about how important it is to have a board that brings resources to the table, and having an accountable board of directors. So we offer trainings around what your roles and responsibilities are, how to build that diverse board, how to run effective board meetings. Of course, fund development for nonprofits is also a very core of our programs. We offer trainings around everything from annual giving, special events, which we don't promote very well as being high return for funding, planned giving, capital campaigns, endowments, all the way through the list of different ways that nonprofits can build their revenue. And as my colleague talked about earlier, it's really important for nonprofit organizations to really diversify the types of funding that come into their organizations. If you rely solely on one type of funding, say a grant, and that grant doesn't come through for you, what's your organization going to do? So we really encourage that all of our nonprofits really seek diverse funding. Leadership in the sector is very important. With all of the work that the nonprofit sector does and different organizations do within our community, oftentimes they are leaders in the community. So we have different trainings around public speaking, around collaboration, which involves a great amount of leadership. And then, of course, the management and planning of nonprofit organizations. I heard earlier someone say that a nonprofit is a tax status, not a business plan, and that is very true. Nonprofits need to be business savvy, and they need to understand management and planning issues. Some of the different offerings that we have here in San Luis Obispo, we have partnered with Cal Poly Continuing Education and have offered a Development Officer Certificate Program, which is a 3-day course for nonprofit volunteers, staff, and board members to really understand the critical components of fund development from annual giving all the way to endowments. And then volunteer management. We heard earlier a lot about the importance of volunteers in nonprofits, and volunteers are really the lifeblood of all nonprofit organizations. And being able to manage those volunteers in an effective way is very critical for those volunteers to keep coming back. So we teach this class with Cal Poly Continuing Education and offer it once a year so that nonprofits do have the capacity to take on volunteers. I talked a little bit earlier about our peer-to-peer networking opportunities. And these, again, are opportunities for executive directors to come together or development staff to come together and really tackle issues that are important to them and use each other as resources. I have a really exciting story to tell about our development roundtable. We had one of the local foundations come and give a presentation to our development roundtable in August of this year, and met a new nonprofit organization, and I just read in the paper about 2 weeks ago that they received $87,000 as a result of that meeting. Volunteer Managers Roundtable. Again, this is ongoing opportunity for those of us who serve nonprofits and serve volunteers in our nonprofits to come together to share resources, to share good ideas on how to recruit and continue to retain volunteers. The Nonprofit Support Center also has specialized consulting services, and these services are around strategic planning for nonprofits, so building a better business plan, cross-cultural communication, and we currently offer executive transition services, which allows for a nonprofit that's going into transition, who maybe they've lost their executive director, maybe they moved to another state, we place an interim executive director in that nonprofit agency to keep that organization moving along and the programs moving along while the board makes a decision on a permanent executive director. And then, of course, our resource center. That's probably one of the most exciting things that we have here in San Luis Obispo is our access to our new resource center here. We have access to GuideStar, so if you're looking for that 990, you can come on down and we can download that for you. We have over 250 titles that are specific to nonprofit management, so everything from how to start a nonprofit to how to write a grant to how to build your board. The resource library is open to the public 2 days a week, and I would encourage any of you to come down and visit our resources. In closing, I would just like to say that Greg talked about our social economy and how it is a collective powerful force in our community, and I believe that the nonprofit sector here really makes up the fabric of our society and makes our community what it is. And so I would ask that the commissioners here tonight continue to build the strong sector by being aware of the nonprofits in our community and the services that they do provide, and also to understand the resources that are available. Not only at the Nonprofit Support Center, but with the different foundations, United Way Community Foundation here. They're great organizations that are always there for our community, providing information and resources. We have great colleges, Cal Poly and Cuesta, that offer different types of trainings. And we at the Nonprofit Support Center really try to bring all of that together so that for those of us that are looking to better our community, there is a resource available. Thank you. Questions, yes.
How are you funded? Are you state funded or are you county funded?
We are actually funded through grants, through individual giving, and through our programs. We bring in revenue through our programs.
Charge for these programs.
We do. And I'd like to say that our fees for our programs are very low, and the reason that they are low is that we get funding from foundations to offset those costs. So our funding is from foundations, both Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, you talked about the total number of nonprofit organizations in Santa Barbara and San Luis and Monterey. Have you done a ratio compared to population? I'm tricking on C3.
You know, I haven't. I was thinking about how it would be, that would be an interesting statistic to look at countywide, what counties are similar in size and look at that. And Barry, do you have any information around that?
The last report that I saw was dated in 2003, and it broke down the number of nonprofits per resident on a county level. And there are the 55 counties in the state of California. San Luis Obispo ranked about 15th for the number of nonprofits per resident.
Is that C3?
C3.
Yeah, C3. That compared to Santa Barbara and Monterey.
I believe is first on that list.
Santa Barbara's competing with Marin County for the most nonprofits per person.
Per person. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
Yes, you might say something about the membership.
Oh, sure.
To the Nonprofit Support Center for those that are out there that
Thank
might
you,
be
Sue.
On nonprofit.
We are a membership organization. We do to help offset some of the costs for our programs. We do have membership, which allows you access to a different level of resources. It allows you a reduced fee on your trainings. You can access the Foundation Center, which is an online database of donors. You can access GuideStar through your membership. Our membership is comparable to what a chamber membership would be, and probably actually even a little bit less, and it's on a sliding scale based on your agency's budget. So as we saw here tonight, there are many, many nonprofits here in San Luis Obispo County that are either all volunteer organizations or really their revenues are very small, and those nonprofit organizations would fall into the $100 a year membership fee, and that allows everyone within their organization, all of their volunteers and board members, and if they had paid staff, access to membership benefits. It's one of the ways that we can earn revenue to offset our costs. I also like to highlight that we have a lot of free resources, and really I think it's important for nonprofits to come in and really get a sense of what resources we do have available before they even sign up for membership. So our office here in San Luis Obispo is staffed 2 times a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays all day, by myself and a resource coordinator, and we are full of information about nonprofits and happy to help you whether or not you're a member or not. Thank you, Sue.
So, in closing, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to make this presentation to you, and whether it's an organization as old as United Way or Big Brothers and Big Sisters or as new as the Nonprofit Support Center or celebrating their 10th anniversary. I don't know if everybody saw that in the paper about the Community Foundation, which is a tremendously, I think, asset for this community. We want folks to be better at being nonprofits. That's what we're really about. We want to make sure that everyone has access to the kinds of services and resources that are going to help the third sector be the strongest sector of our economy one of these days. So again, thank you. Thank all of my colleagues for coming tonight, taking their time out to do this, and thank you for hearing us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, all of you, for spending this evening with us. We really appreciate your time and your effort, and I think we all learned something this evening. Many nonprofits are focused on the health of the members of our community, and so thank you again. All right, we'll move on to the next item on our agenda. Dr. Borenstein is here to give us the health agency report.
Thanks. I look forward to the day when I can come here with all kinds of rosy news, but we're not there yet, and probably won't be for some time. By way of budget, we actually are beginning our process right now to plan for fiscal year 09-10. The ink is still not dry on the current fiscal year, especially as you follow the news out of the state. Clearly, there may be additional revenue reductions this year, but we are planning for next year. Our direction from the County Administrative Office is to plan for, at best, level funding, which we think will be, and possibly even a decrease of 5%. So given the increased cost, we're looking at somewhere around $3 to $3.5 million that we will have to reduce in our budget going into next year. The Public Health Department, we've already begun that process, and we've held a number of vacancies, so we'll certainly be looking toward that to help get to our mark. And we've continued to take a very close look at priorities, efficiencies. That's the mode we're in, and we'll be in for some time. Along with that, as I described, the pain that's coming down from the state level is not just to our budgets, but to our recipients of services. So the one that is really most on my mind these days is the Healthy Families Program. This is the state child health insurance program in California called Healthy Families. It's been in place for about a decade. And during that period of time, it has experienced growth and has never been capped. The board that oversees that program is separate from the California Department of Public Health and the Department of Health Services. They are, at their December meeting, going to take up the probability of actually putting an enrollment cap on that program. In San Luis Obispo County, we enroll about 150, 160 new families, new children on the rolls every month. We have a total enrollment of about 5,100 right now. And what this would mean for us if the day after their meeting, which is scheduled December 17th, they are planning on putting that wait list into place, meaning that we would have to maintain our rolls through attrition, achieve a decreased enrollment of about 900 and then maintain that through the balance of the fiscal year. So that is a significant number of children that would be left without health insurance, which is obviously going in the wrong direction. Simultaneously, the new leader in the Senate, Senator Steinberg, is talking about resurrecting the opportunity for universal health care coverage in the state of California. So we'll just have to see how this all plays out. But these are interesting times, and stay tuned. I do want to, I never like to come without just a little bit of good news. We had our environmental health division had their last of seven city council meetings to discuss and vote on approval for the Vector Benefit Control District. What this is the unincorporated areas of San Luis are going to be looking to have a ballot initiative, which is probably going to be about $9 a month for each household to put into place a mosquito, a full-fledged mosquito abatement surveillance program for beneficiaries, homeowners. Last week's seventh meeting, all seven municipalities have now agreed to sign on to that assessment vote as well. So we're looking to have the whole county covered should the votes in each one of those jurisdictions come up positive. And what that will allow us to do, as I said, is to have ongoing mosquito abatement and surveillance program to protect us. Ultimately, what that is aimed at is to avoid mosquito-borne infections and other types of infections. So, you know, West Nile virus, Eastern encephalitis, Lyme disease, plague, a whole host of infections that we try to keep at bay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that report. We'll move on now to the Health Commission updates. The chair does not have anything to update you on. Is there anyone that has a report they would like to make tonight? Commissioner Hetherington.
Just a quick note, the Domestic Violence Task Force did meet November 19th. That was right after our last meeting. The Delta Project, which is the educational outreach in dating violence, had a good month of outreach at the farmers market. They have a new billboard up about Beat the Punch. They're also recertifying batters intervention groups. The new courthouse in Paso opened, and they're going to be having a domestic violence case, or civil court, I think they're working towards that, there and in San Luis Obispo. They're going through training right now for all of the first responders in the police department so that they're up to speed on what to look for in domestic violence cases and the reporting mechanisms that guarantee that there will be some prosecution.
Thank you. Commissioner Arnold?
Yes, I just wanted to call your attention to this article in the Wednesday, November 26th issue of the Tribune. Headline, U.S. cancer rate is on the decline for the first time. Deaths dropped too. But then when you look in the fine print, it says the rate of new breast cancer dropped about 2.2% a year, due largely to millions of women abandoning hormone replacement therapy starting around 2002. The death rate dropped 1.8% a year. And then down here under melanoma, the deadliest skin cancer jumped 7.7% a year among men and by nearly 3% a year among women. Kidney cancer incidence is rising about 2% a year for both sexes. And then the last paragraph says, some experts argue that the decrease in new cases is primarily the result of a drop in lung cancer, which is due to declines in smoking, that occurred decades ago. They criticize the ongoing focus on detecting and treating cancer and call for more focus on prevention. And that's what I would like to see. Thank you.
Thank you for that information, Commissioner Munson.
Just a short report on the Adult Services Policy Council. The meeting was last week. And since there was so much bad news in November, the participants were asked to share good news and good things that have happened during the year. And as it turned out, there was a number of wonderful stories that were shared. But the interesting thing was that people walked away, I think, with the feeling of just what the nonprofit people were talking about tonight. They've seen already, this is a council that has government agencies, nonprofits, for-profits. It's quite a mix of agencies that provide services in the community. And with the budget cuts that they've seen, they're already starting to work together more, to collaborate, to talk about using resources better and sharing resources as time goes on. Because if they don't, they're realizing that we're not going to be able to continue to, they're not going to be able to continue to provide services at the level, obviously, that they could in the past. And so they're very much focused on that. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that in the months to come.
Dr. Craven?
Yes, the Oral Health Commission met last Tuesday for this first meeting, and we had about 26 people there from various organizations that have to do with mainly children's oral health. And they're trying to get a handle and cooperate with all the services that are available and coordinate it with the first five commission that got this thing going. And hopefully we kind of brainstorm the whole session, and we'll be meeting again in the first part of February.
Commissioner Hetherington, you had a question on Dr. Craven.
Dr. Craven, are they just mainly focusing on children's oral health or adults as well?
Yes, this is mainly focusing on children.
Okay. I had heard a complaint recently of somebody that was a Medi-Cal recipient was having a hard time going through teeth extraction because she needed a number of teeth pulled, but there wasn't any entity that would knock her out to do that.
Well, that's true, because of the fee reimbursement by Medi-Cal or even the denial of Medi-Cal, because it's not considered a medical necessity to be knocked out to have teeth out. You can have local anesthetic and do quite well. I don't have a private practice anymore. I still go after the prison. They don't get knocked out, but they sure would like to be. And some
that
of them may want to.
That clarifies quite a bit.
Yeah.
One tooth at a time, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. That ending the commissioner reports. I was not aware that any of our committees met this past month, so I don't think there's any committee reports. And moves us right into the last item, which is discussing our future items. We will meet in January, and the plan was from our retreat that we would be having an update on the trauma system and the 211 hot date and the VOAD organization. So hopefully that's what we'll be talking about in January. And in February, at this point, we will have no meeting. We had planned at our retreat last summer that we would be dark in February because of the several county holidays that occur, unless we find that there's a compelling reason for us to meet, and we have a program that we just can't miss. So, Dr. Craven.
Yeah, I have. I didn't turn it off. Dr. Hansen brought up one thing that I thought might be worthwhile for us to send a letter to the Sheriff's Department, since I know the prisons now do not allow tobacco products, and I was unaware that the Sheriff's Department still did, and I think it would be a good idea as a health commission to send a note to them requesting that perhaps they do whatever is necessary to prevent the use of tobacco products at the county facility.
Thank you for bringing that up. Why is not our county health campus smoke-free? Dr. Borenstein?
You saw me smiling during Dr. Hansen's presentation. I wouldn't characterize it as we're too busy. That's not what's happening. It was one of the first things that I got on when I arrived here. What has to happen, as I've gotten more information from County Council, is their interpretation is that we would need a local ordinance to bring about smoke-free campuses. So unlike the hospitals and private facilities, who could do it as a matter of policy, we have to go down a legislative path. We are talking about doing that. Some of the issues that arise are health campus locally here in SLO. We have other sites where we deliver services outside of the city, and then there are other county campuses. So there's some discussion taking place, and then particularly the inpatient mental health unit. It's about 50-50. We're gathering information about how others handle that. Some there are some inpatient mental health units in county government that exclude those facilities from the ban, and others that include them. So we want to, just get all the information before we move forward trying to do something locally.
Same policy would affect the jail then, being a county organization as well, is that correct?
If it were to be a county-wide ordinance as opposed to, where I'd like to start personally is at least with the health campus. It seems ironic that folks smoke right outside our tobacco control program. 20 feet out, but still. We're just looking at what the county may want to do in terms of expanding that.
So it would really be up to each department then really to have their own ordinance. Dr. Craven was talking about the sheriff's department, meaning I presume you meant the jail itself. So would they require, would that be your understanding from County Council that they would require an ordinance as well, or?
No, my understanding is that we can be as narrow or expansive in developing such an ordinance. I don't have jurisdiction over the county's decision-making regarding other county campuses. And ultimately, the Board of Supervisors would have to weigh in on even an ordinance as restrictive as the health agency campus alone.
Okay. So in response, though, I think, Dr. Craven, if the Health Commission were to support or write a letter about the Sheriff's Department or the health campus or whatever, that's an action item, and we would have to have it on our agenda for next month, which we can do.
I would suggest we do have it on the agenda for next one and have somebody present, from the county council or somebody that would clarify this to us before we took our action.
Okay, that's a good idea. And Commissioner Warren, you had
I have some comments on that because drug and alcohol had already had a smoke-free campus, and I know that the Atascadero unit, that they have to go out on the street. They can't smoke anywhere around the building. It's 120 feet or something like that.
20 feet.
Or 20 feet. But they have to go out on the street. And they did that some years ago. And at the jail itself, the prisoners cannot smoke. They get the privilege back when they go to the honor farm. And
I know in talking to a few people, they're not sure that was a privilege, but it's hard if you've quit smoking there and then you go to the auto farm and everybody's smoking to maintain that. And then I don't know how it applies to the staff.
I don't have the answers to that specifically at the jail, but I can address the 20 feet rule is actually in state law, and that's why the county council's interpretation was that if we were to do something more restrictive in the public settings, where it's not just for our staff but members of the public, that we'd be placing a higher level of restriction by saying off campus, which means curb to curb. So in some places, depending on the nature of that program location, 20 feet might put you in the street. In other places, you know, that have a large parking lot, that's a larger distance to cover.
So we're going to put it on next month's agenda then?
We can do that.
Yeah, I would suggest we do and get some clarification, some of this.
Okay.
Because I'm not entirely clear what's permissible, but it seems like San Luis Obispo County was the first city, was the first to ban smoking in bars, you know. That was a few years ago.
Yeah, it seems like it was just yesterday, but I guess it was a few years ago. Commissioner Arnold, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yes, I'm certainly in favor of putting that on the agenda. The other item that Dr. Hansen mentioned was, I think he said he was asking us to write a letter in favor of development of a vaccine for Valley Fever. Did I hear correctly? To the Centers for Disease Control. So I figure, Sam, that's kind of your side of the grade. Do you want us to put that on the agenda?
I think we'd need to have a little more information about that. What do you think, Commissioner Hudson?
I think we've already weighed in on that at one point a number of years ago. I don't know if it was the last outbreak or the outbreak before that, but I'm sure that if Jean wouldn't mind giving Dr. Hansen a call and providing the information, I would be happy to help.
Lynn?
I thought he had talked about research that had been ongoing and then has kind of stabilized and or disappeared, and that he was hoping that a letter might jog somebody somewhere.
Okay, so we can add to next month's agenda the smoking issue and the research on COXIE. Commissioner Hetherington?
I was a little dismayed by Dr. Hansen's comment about he doesn't know quite what the Health Commission does. He's been before us, I would say, a few dozen times asking for our help on various items, which we have gladly given him and supported him through a number of issues. So I would hope that he would be a little bit more generous in his comments. And perhaps maybe what we should do is generate a timeline over the life of the Health Commission of the issues that we have addressed, just to jog his memory.
That would be quite an undertaking. and perhaps we could accomplish that sometime before the end of the year. Not this year, but next year.
Yeah. I think that would be nice.
Might be a nice project. However, I know our staff is very busy, and it would be so it might be something we'd have to maybe try and take on one of us or several of us ourselves. Okay. Is there anything further from commissioners then this evening? If not, we're coming to the end of the meeting. I'd like to wish everyone happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and
cookies.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for the
and
cookies,
I hope that everyone remembers the nonprofits and is able to give generously, as we always have, of time and money. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. I'm sure.